Not exactly, Big Brother, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Private companies are using cameras to read license plate numbers on cars, and now immigration officials want access to that data. It's not exactly Big Brother, but
it really is this sort of nationwide surveillance network that's been built up privately outside of the reach of a lot of safeguards that would normally exist.
And at least one sanctuary city has raised concerns with the company that collects data there.
They have assured us they didn't share any of our data. However, we are going to want to ensure moving forward as much as possible that it's not shared.
Privacy, public safety, and ICE. That story plus how Koreans celebrate the Lunar New Year here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us this Friday. Immigration reform was at the top of the agenda in the U.S. Senate this week, and some might have expected lawmakers to actually make some progress, hammering out details on DACA, border security, legal immigration, and other parts of immigration policy, following some healthy debate on the Senate floor. But that is not what happened. There were four plans of legislative action on the table, and now all four of them are dead in the water.
I think it's safe to say this has been a disappointing week.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell expressed frustration, and I guess no surprise here. He said the Democrats were the ones to blame. The thing is, there did seem to be an opening here for some bipartisan agreement on immigration. Monica Campbell heads up our Global Nation desk. What happened on the Hill, Monica?
For a moment, there was a bipartisan proposal that got some traction. It was a plan to protect people with DACA, to provide billions for border security, but it fell 6 votes short in the Senate, and so did every other proposal. So that's where we're at. And the sticking points, it should be mentioned, that are still...
Yeah, what are they?
Yeah, the sticking points are still, you know, the big slashes to family-based migration system and ending the diversity visa lottery. This reflects how this debate has shifted from DACA and to some extent border security, and it's turned into this really wider battle over legal migration, which is much more complicated, much more expansive, and much tougher.
So what's next for immigration reform, and is there any hope of Congress reaching a deal?
You know, it's not looking good. Many administrations have tried this and failed. We've got elections that will complicate this, and in this case, the midterms, with a lot of politicians who are uneasy about taking a big stand on immigration, especially in more conservative parts of the country. So it's gridlock. And in the meantime, you know, we've got status quo and ICE operations at full steam.
Right. And Trump announced back in September that he would phase out deferred action for childhood arrivals on March 5th. That was a deadline, he said, for Congress to at least come up with agreement. Where does this leave those 700,000 plus DACA recipients?
So it's not like on March 5th, you know, nearly 700,000 people who have DACA are going to fall over this cliff. People have already been losing their status, and there's a lot of worry about what the future is for this program. You've got a lot of complication, you know, and even involving the Supreme Court, perhaps, when it comes to this program and the fate of it. So if you have DACA, you may be losing your status. Maybe you got a renewal, or you don't know what's going to happen, you know, over the next months.
Meantime, I see deportation numbers under Trump are still lagging behind the later Obama years, but the role of ICE actually seems to have grown. There have been numerous raids, and there are new numbers on who is being arrested and detained. What are you seeing?
Well, ICE arrests are way up. They're up more than 40% in the year Trump took office. And the arrests are people who have a criminal record, some people who have violent criminal records, and a lot of people who have nonviolent criminal records. So that's where we're seeing some of these more kind of shocking and surprising cases where people who've lived in the country for years might have U.S. citizen children or big parts of the community, but maybe this person got a DUI 8 years ago. ICE is going through the records and saying, you know, this person kind of represents this low-hanging fruit. You know, we can go after this person and deport them. And that is representing a large number of these arrests.
We're about to hear, in fact, about a deal that ICE has made with a company that holds a massive database of vehicle license plate information. What do you make of this deal? Like, what is your understanding about ICE's directive or mandate here?
ICE has a very wide mandate, a very broad mandate. Trump basically said anyone who is undocumented or living in the United States without authorization is open to deportation. So ICE is using databases, different ways they can go back and look at someone's history. And that's where we're seeing real pushback in California on its ability to get into those databases. At the same time, we're also seeing ICE step up in California, especially its inspections at businesses. You know, we heard about the 7-Eleven case, you know, throughout the country, but we're seeing more of those worksite inspections. And that creates a lot of fear in the community. And that seems to be what a lot of advocates say is sort of the goal here.
The World's Monica Campbell, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Now to that story about ICE gaining access to a massive license plate recognition database. That system is run by the California-based company, Vigilant Solutions. It says it captures some 100 million plates per month. That's all according to a report by Russell Brandom. He's with the news website The Verge. The contract between Vigilant and ICE has some people worried about how the agency might use the database as it steps up its crackdown on undocumented immigrants. I asked Brandom how the database works.
There are two main things that you can do with the database. One is if you have a specific plate you're looking for, you can see all the places that plate has been spotted historically, sort of looking into the past. The other thing, which is I think a little more alarming, is the hot list. So you can add that plate to a hot list so that going forward, if any of the cameras in the network capture that plate, there will be an instant alert sent to ICE. So essentially, this is an ICE agent gets an alert on his phone. He gets an email saying, you know, this car just drove past this camera right now.
So there's this whole network of cameras that's picking up this license plate data. Tell us about that network and how Vigilant Solutions gets that data.
Most of it is from municipal agencies. A local police department will either decide to put some license plate readers on police cars, sort of mounted mobile readers, or they'll set up fixed point cameras. And, you know, when they're making this decision, it's sort of expensive to build and operate these cameras. So often when they're getting them, they'll partner with Vigilant, who will say, you know, we'll give you a break on the price, we'll operate it for free, we'll sort of plug you into this larger network in exchange for you feeding this data back to this network. So, I mean, it's tricky because each of the data sharing arrangements is a little different, but it really is this sort of nationwide surveillance network that's been built up privately outside of the reach of a lot of the safeguards that would normally exist if ICE had built this database itself or if we were getting it sort of from some federal agency.
Russell, don't privacy concerns come into play when you've got a third party sharing this data with law enforcement?
Well, so this is what's tricky, right? Because it's in most cases, it's law enforcement sharing it with other law enforcement. In theory, most of this data is still controlled by the agency that owns the cameras. But there's a lot of these opt-in settings where if you're opting into federal alerts, that ends up giving ICE a path. And a lot of these people are sharing it without realizing that they're sharing it.
What has Vigilant said about all of this?
Throughout their life as a company, they've been very consistent that their mission is to support federal, state, and local governments, right? And specifically on the law enforcement side. What's happening now is you have this real political conflict between ICE as a federal agency and the desires of local governments, whether it's at the state level or the county level or the city level, where, you know, the mayor of many, many towns and many city councils have said, look, we're a sanctuary city. We do not want to take part in the federal immigration efforts that the Trump administration is sort of pushing. And at the same time, you have ICE becoming much more aggressive and much less targeted and sort of coherent in what their deportation efforts are trying to achieve. And I think when you have that being mediated by a private corporation, it gets even more complicated.
Russell Brandom there with The Verge. Vigilant's contract with ICE has at least one sanctuary city concerned about its relationship with the company. Alameda, California sits across the bay from San Francisco. Part of the city is on an island in the bay. Officials in Alameda have been working with Vigilant since 2014, feeding license plate data from the 12 cameras mounted on city police cars. Now, at the recommendation of the police chief, the city is looking to add more fixed cameras on the bridges leading to that island to respond to an increase in crime in recent years. And at a recent meeting, Alameda City Council asked the chief to open up a bidding process for that contract and look beyond vigilant. I asked Mayor Trish Herrera Spencer about that decision.
Because of the recent concerns with vigilant, the proposal is actually to go back to the chief to put out a new request and see what companies apply and to try to come up with a firewall. That's what I'm going to call it, in regards to the data that's collected, to try to ensure that it does not get shared with ICE. And that would go out to all companies, not just Vigilant, to give their response to try to get that contract. So we may or may not be staying with Vigilant long term.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, is there an expiration date for the current contract with Vigilant, and are you reassessing future relationships with Vigilant?
Yes, we are looking at the – my understanding is we're looking at the entire moving forward, if that's the chief if that is continues to be his recommendation to purchase these cameras. And one question was, could we switch to a new company and have a new company service the existing cameras that we already purchased through Vigilant? So the way these cameras work is you buy the cameras with the same company that then services them. So we bought the cameras 4 years ago from Vigilant. So that is the question, is now that we have these existing cameras, the 12 that we already have, can another company actually collect the data from those cameras?
What have you heard from Alameda residents about how they want to move forward with this and what their concerns are?
The primary concerns, I'll say there are three of them. The increase in crime. The public does, our community, of course, does want to live in a safe community. Mm. So that's the first concern. Second that we heard was, in fact, the privacy concern, because even though we currently have the cameras fixed on cars, the police cars that are moving around town, four of these cars, the leap from having them on cars to having them actually at every entrance on and off the island in the peninsula, that was another concern of the community. And then thirdly, it is the relationship, the existing relationship with Vigilant, and what are our alternatives if we move forward with purchasing more cameras? What other companies are out there, and would they in fact be able to service the existing cameras that we have?
So Alameda is a sanctuary city, and California is a sanctuary state. Practically, what does that mean? And if you do decide to move forward with this proposal, with any company, will that come into conflict with your city's and state's sanctuary status?
So that's the concern working with Vigilant after it was shared, right, that they had entered into a contract with ICE and the federal government.
Right.
From council members as well as the community.
And as you look at other companies, are you making sure they don't have those connections with ICE or the federal government
I'm
database?
I'm sure that will come up. And they... You know, so Vigilant, in all fairness to them, they have said that our data was not shared.
The data of Alameda specifically, you're saying?
Right. Data of Alameda specifically was not shared, is what we were told. And they did ensure that, in fact, any data collected is kept separate. However, it is our council's position that we do want to do our utmost to ensure that the data is, in fact, not shared with ICE.
Right. So those reassurances from Vigilant, that they were not satisfactory?
I think the preference, we will be looking for more assurance, I expect, if in fact it is the chief's recommendation to continue working with them.
Trish Herrera-Spencer is the mayor of Alameda, California. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Coming up on the show, we talk Olympics and Lunar New Year in Seoul. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. I'm telling you, what an exciting week in Pyeongchang. Some upset, some amazing visuals. Snowboard cross, I've discovered, is enough to make you chew your nails down to the quick. Reporter Jason Strother joins us from Seoul. The North Korean cheerleading squad, I see, is still the talk of the town, but I'm also seeing there's a dark side that we should talk about. They may be smiling in their red outfits, but not far away from them, a crew of black mask North Korean heavies are watching them very carefully. Who are those guys? To quote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and how present are they whenever the North Koreans move around?
Sure. Well, Pyongyang is not going to let any of its citizens come down to the South and move around freely, whether it's the cheerleaders, it's ice skaters, it's hockey players. There are minders everywhere. On one hand, it's to prevent these North Koreans from defecting. But, you know, they are, in a sense, prisoners. Even when they come here to South Korea, there is no freedom of movement.
So let's talk about American snowboarder Chloe Kim. She speaks Korean. She's super dynamic. She's media savvy. What's the reaction been this week?
Well, you know, I think whenever Korean Americans or Koreans that are born overseas, South Korea tries to claim them as their own to some degree. And I think there's been a lot of pride, not just in Chloe Kim, who media here sometimes refer to her by her Korean name, Kim Son, but to her entire family. We heard her dad saying this was the American dream when Chloe won the gold medal. But in some ways, this is also the Korean dream.
I hear that she was doing an interview with South Korean TV and there was an interpreter. And at one point, she just kind of like did her own answers in Korean. How did people react to that?
She did not need a translator.
No,
I've heard her talking on Korean television and she appears to feel quite comfortable over here.
What about attendance, Jason? Because we're seeing some empty seats in the stands. I know it happens at other Olympics, but what's going on in Pyeongchang?
There could be several factors behind this. One is timing. It would seem that some of these events are scheduled more for North American or European audiences than the domestic market. South Korea, we're 14 hours ahead of the East Coast, so it's not so convenient. But also, South Korea is not really a winter sport kind of country. Mm. There's not that much passion about the sports, except for the events that Koreans are expected to medal in.
So you've got a story for us now from South Korea, Jason. It's not about the Olympics, but about the Lunar New Year, which I know is a big holiday today in South Korea. Is it more on people's minds than the Olympics?
Well, I don't think the two are mutually exclusive, Marco. The Lunar New Year not only involves venerating your ancestors, it also involves copious amounts of eating and watching television. And I'm sure when many people have gone back out to the countryside to spend time with their parents, grandparents, aunts and uncles, they're watching the games on the tube.
And this is the year of the dog, right? Why is that significant?
There are a lot of beliefs with being born in the year of the dog. And in this story, I speak with a couple who are expecting their first child later this year.
All right, let's check out your story.
Yoon Ji-young is laying down slabs of fatty pork belly onto a tabletop grill in her kitchen. She's 4 months pregnant and says she's been craving meaty dishes that she normally avoids.
Weirdly, I have a strong craving for junk food, like hamburgers, which I rarely eat.
She told her mom about this craving, and her mom said, it's only natural because your husband is a Western man.
Matthew Crawford, he's Canadian.
Of course you're craving hamburgers. The baby's craving hamburgers.
I caught up with Matt and Ji-young, who've been married for 3 years, before they head out of town for the Lunar New Year, known here as Sola. Ji-young says they'll spend the holiday with her family.
They're all very excited, and Because this little one is the first grandchild for both sides. Both sides' families are really looking forward.
Based on the Chinese zodiac, their child will be born in the year of the dog. More precisely, the year of the golden dog, which only comes around every 60 years. Someone born in a dog year is said to be intelligent and loyal. Ji-young says she doesn't know much about the golden dog, so she gives her mother, Eun-suk, a call. Eun-suk says Koreans believe that having a child in a golden year is especially lucky. It means a prosperous life. But then she says that she doesn't really buy into all those notions. She's just excited about becoming a grandmother.
Does it mean that we'll get rich or the child will... will get us rich?
Yeah, rich somehow. And healthy, all that kind of, you know, good signs.
Ji-young says she's grateful that, unlike many Korean parents, her mom and dad never pressured her to marry or produce a grandchild, especially a grandson. In the past, that insistence for a boy led to a rise in sex-selective abortions. Now, it's illegal for an obstetrician to reveal a baby's gender in utero. But Ji-young says during a recent ultrasound, her doctor found a way to spill the beans.
She just stopped and pointed out something on the screen, saying, "Oh, I see something here."
Ji-young says she realized the doctor was trying to give her a hint. So she asked,
"Do you think the something looks pretty or handsome?" And she said, doctor said, "I think it seems to be handsome," and grinning. She grinned.
The couple says they were pretty sure it was going to be a girl, but are perfectly happy that it's a boy. They joke about how they're helping increase South Korea's birth rate, one of the world's lowest. The high cost of raising children here is a big reason Korean couples decide to only have one child, or none at all. Ji-young tells me it's expensive in part because parents are expected to spend lots of money on their kids' education even before they're born.
I think all the pregnant women are so obsessed with the education to make the child smarter, better than the others. Babies have to be competitive, you know.
And do you feel pressured to...
Yeah.
Try to make your baby
Yeah,
smart.
Because everybody, I mean, most, every pregnant women are doing the same thing. So if I don't do that, then I feel like, oh, my baby's behind.
To get an edge on the competition, the couple plays Mozart in the evenings. And Matthew says he sometimes reads poetry out loud to his wife's belly. Like other married couples in Korea, they put off having kids. They're both career-focused. He writes education material. She's a business analyst. Matt, who's 37, says they worried they might have waited too long, but everything has fallen into place.
Ji-young is kind of at the cusp. She's 35 right now, so getting a little bit old. And
he said you're getting old.
I'm medically and biologically old, I agree. I have no doubt. Yeah, I think this could be the right time type of baby for us. And we are hopeful for the future, economically stable to raise a child. I'm happy with everything now.
Year of the dog or not, Ji-young and Matthew say it's a good year to start their family. For the world, Jason Strother, Seoul.
I'm Marco Werman. Leonardo da Vinci's old notebooks are filled with wonders that really aren't out of place today.
The water-powered clock, it's digital in its conception, and I find that is the point where he really left the face of the earth and went into the modern age.
Finding Leonardo's lost notebooks, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Three major stories from Africa this week, all of which point to sea changes in three big countries. First up, Ethiopia, Africa's second most populous country, where the prime minister resigned unexpectedly yesterday.
I believe the Ethiopian parliament will accept my resignation. The main reason for handing in my resignation is my belief that it's important to be part of the solution to ensure sustainable peace and unwavering democracy in our country.
A lot of Ethiopians would say Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn didn't really have a choice in the matter. There's been a lot of pent-up anger among ethnic groups in Ethiopia that have felt sidelined by the government. The prime minister had recently sought to ease the pressure by releasing thousands of political prisoners, but his resignation was the ultimate move to let the pressure out for now. Next, Zimbabwe, a country trying to figure out its future with a new leader, very much in the same mold of Robert Mugabe, who was pushed out late last year. This week, a huge setback with the death of Morgan Tsvangirai, Zimbabwe's most promising opposition leader. This is Nelson Chamisa, number two in the party that Tsvangirai was president of, the Movement for Democratic Change.
President Tsvangirai managed to bring together the students, the workers, commercial farmers, traditional leaders, war veterans, business people.
And finally, just next door in South Africa, with the threat of an impeachment vote over massive corruption, this announcement from President Jacob Zuma on Wednesday night.
I have therefore come to the decision to resign as President of the Republic with immediate effect.
So big questions about what's next in three critical countries on the continent. We're going to spend the next few minutes focusing on South Africa, where at least the near term is pretty clear. There is a new president, Cyril Ramaphosa. But who is he? Our old friend in Cape Town, correspondent Mohammed Ali, has followed Ramaphosa's career through the decades.
He started out as a man of the people, formed the National Union of Mine Workers at a critical time in South African history when the apartheid regime was cracking down on all kinds of opposition. And they organized one of the biggest strikes that was seen in this country in 1987, worked his way through when the ANC was unbanned, became the general secretary, was the chief negotiator during the years of negotiations with the National Party. He went into business, but I think he's back where he wants to be and where he belongs. Many people would feel in South Africa.
Let's go back to those early years when he was the founder of the National Union of Mine Workers. What was he best known for in that time?
I think for organizing the workers and starting really from scratch. I think they had a few hundred members when they started out. And the fact that he was able to grow the National Union of Mine Workers from a few hundred supporters to 30,000 at least is a testament to Cyril Ramaphosa's organizing skills.
Then he switched sides, right? I mean, he was this labor union leader, but then he was on the board of a mining company. And in that massacre of wildcat strikers at the platinum mine a few years ago, didn't he play a pretty controversial role in that?
Absolutely. He proceeded to become one of the richest people in South Africa. In fact, he's rated now as the 10th richest person in the country. He, as you mentioned, had shareholding in Lonmin, one of the biggest mining multinational mining corporation. And there was controversy in 2012 where 34 mine workers were killed. And it later emerged that he had actually sent an email to police asking them to take action to stop the actions of the miners.
Jacob Zuma's years as president, as we know, were rife with corruption. Some say he systematically looted the country. State capture is a phrase that I now know quite well. During Zuma's time in office, did Ramaphosa do anything to kind of stand in the way of corruption?
That was one of the big criticisms of Ramaphosa during his time as deputy president. He didn't say much. But then again, there wasn't much he could do. I think it was just a case of biding his time as deputy president, waiting for the moment to arrive, which has indeed arrived now.
Are most South Africans optimistic about the prospects for President Ramaphosa?
He's got something of a Mandela-esque stature about him. Obviously not the same, but he was right next to Nelson Mandela when Nelson Mandela was released from prison. And immediately when he became president, you can just see he's trying to connect with the people. Yesterday and the day before, he was running on the promenade on the beachfront of one of Cape Town's more affluent areas where people run in the mornings. And, you know, people posted pictures with the new president on social media. And I think he will play the role of a unifier, I think. And it was very interesting just watching the opening of the State of the Nation address that all the political parties actually applauded Cyril Ramaphosa, which is unheard of during the Jacob Zuma era.
You mentioned Nelson Mandela, Mohammed, and I just want to kind of pull back a bit and put all of this news from South Africa in broader historical context. This is actually Nelson Mandela speaking 2 weeks prior to South Africa's first free elections in 1994. This is during a televised debate with then-president F.W. de Klerk.
We will be able to prevent the corruption which is so endemic in the National Party government.
Please, ladies and gentlemen.
The gravy trains where most of the funds of the country have gone have come to an end. We have committed ourselves to leaders trying to lead a style of life similar to those of the community.
Nelson Mandela in 1994 on corruption, the thing that has brought us to Cyril Ramaphosa. Mohammed Ali in Cape Town, can South Africa recapture that idealism we just heard there?
very difficult. You know, people were obviously very, very optimistic, and Nelson Mandela, being the person he was, being the hero and the icon that he was, people were supremely optimistic that we were heading into a new future, which we briefly experienced when this process of building a new, what we called a rainbow nation, was starting to emerge, and Nelson Mandela had this ability to have people eating out of his hands. It's going to be very difficult for Cyril Ramaphosa, almost impossible, I think, because we've lost that kind of, as it were, innocence we had in 1994. But, you know, he certainly started off in the right way. And there's enough skills, there's enough intelligence, there's enough business acumen in this country to lead this country on the right path. And if there's a political will, if there's a will across political parties, political persuasions to all pull in one direction, I certainly see a bright future for South Africa, because we've got the potential to be a great country once again.
Correspondent Muhammad Ali in Cape Town, South Africa. Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you indeed for having me. Always a pleasure chatting to you, Marco.
On the other side of the continent, sad news from Senegal this week. That voice belonged to Medun Diallo, singing there with one of the famous bands he was part of, Africando. Africando was the essence of the Senegalese love of Latin music from the 50s through, well, really through today. And since Medun Diallo knew Spanish, he would often sing the original lyrics to mambo standards from Cuba, or he'd do them in French, or Wolof. The dancers in the clubs in Dakar didn't really care, but it did help the authenticity of the music if the talented Medun Diallo was on stage singing in Spanish. Dale. Before he was a part of Africando, Diallo was often sought out for vocal duties by the renowned Orchestra Baobab after they lost their lead singer in a car crash in 1974. Later, when Diallo helped form Africando, he'd do double duty for both bands and scored a hit with Baobab not that long ago with this rousing Cuban standard, El Son Te Ama. Amigos, te muestro y compa, caramba, que te canto mi comida. I love that song, El Son Te Llama, The Music Calls You, from Orchestra Baobab, featuring the late Medun Diallo on vocals. A lot of old Senegalese recordings from the 60s and 70s are being re-released. But in this next story, getting unearthed gets a whole new meaning. In February 1967, two notebooks belonging to Leonardo da Vinci, lost for centuries, were rediscovered in the National Library in Spain. And while this may sound crazy, they included a design for a robot. The BBC podcast Witness got correspondent Luis Hidalgo to dig in and find out what happened since 1967 to those notebooks.
Leonardo da Vinci is one of the best-known artists of all time. The few works of art of his that have survived, like the Mona Lisa and the Last Supper, are beyond price. But Leonardo wasn't just an artist. He was a scientist and an architect, a musician and an engineer, many of whose inventions, like the flying machine, were the precursor to technology we use today.
I remember a NASA engineer looking at those things. I showed him and he said, oh yeah, that's like such and such person is doing currently. That's what's so interesting about Leonardo. It's so advanced.
Robotics engineer Mark Rosheim was a boy when he first heard about Leonardo's two lost notebooks.
It increased the percentage of drawings by 10-15% of what we have. So it was a red letter day.
People had known for centuries that the Madrid notebooks existed. But over the years, they disappeared, like so many other of Leonardo's writings, says Da Vinci expert Pietro Morani.
Oh, from the beginning of the 17th century, they were thought to be lost forever. And so no one was able to see and to know their content for 4 or 5 centuries.
But in the middle of February 1967, an American university announced that one of its scholars had found the notebooks, misplaced and misnumbered, on a bookshelf of the National Library of Spain. Back in Italy, a young Pietro Morani remembers reading the news in the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera.
I was 15 years old. I read a very exciting article by Anna Maria Brizio on the 2 rediscovered manuscripts. And this article made a turning point in my life, because 3 years after, I decided to go to the university where Anna Maria Brizio was professor here in Milan and become a Leonardo scholar.
The notebooks would become known as the Madrid Codices. Overnight, hugely increasing what was known about Leonardo and his extraordinary talents.
In particular, Madrid first is one of the most important and most clear and ordered notebook concerning mechanics. There are a lot of new information to understand all the elements of one single machine. And the second one is a very disordered manuscript with a lot of topics from hydraulics to painting. And so they are still now 2 of the most important manuscripts by Leonardo.
Leonardo was kind of the Walt Disney of his time, so he was contracted by the powers that be to impress dignitaries and heads of state, and many major projects are represented in the Madrid Codices. For example, there's a drawing of a hang glider, and that has been built, and that works.
But there is one thing that you think is missing, isn't there? There are 16 pages in the first notebook that are gone. And you believe that these pages may have contained the finished drawings of a robot, Leonardo's great robot knight.
Exactly. The robot knight and possibly the robot lion. Leonardo kept folders that had his napkin sketch drawings, and then they would have also had his finished drawings. It's the finished drawings that are missing.
And what do we know about this robot, which you recreated, didn't you?
The reconstruction I did, based on the fragments I found, many of them at Windsor Castle, was a robot knight. It could stand up, sit down, moved its jaw. It had arms that could move. It might have been for the entryway of a park that was outside the Sforza Castle. So it might have been kind of a Renaissance version of an amusement park. And there would have been levers, or somehow the cables went off the robot and they were operated by possibly water power or possibly manual. So he was thinking incredibly in advance of his time.
And the missing pages? Do we know where they could be?
Well, we have about 7,000 pages of Leonardo's notes. 14,000 are missing, enough to fill a walk-in closet.
Robotics engineer Mark Rosheim ending that story by Louise Hidalgo, reporting there for the BBC's Witness program. After the school shooting in Florida this week, Mike Huckabee, the former governor of Arkansas, tweeted this: "Just waking up in Israel to news of heartbreaking school shooting in Florida, reminded that Israel pretty much eliminated it by placing highly trained people strategically to spot the one common thread, not the weapon, but a person with intent." That tweet left some Israelis scratching their heads, so we decided to check in with someone who knows gun culture both here and in Israel. Ben Hartman lives in Tel Aviv, where he's a writer. He's originally from Texas. What do you think Huckabee was referring to there, Ben?
It seems that he was referring to the security that you have at schools in Israel, because on the one hand, he's right, there are security guards at Israeli schools. It's you walk up at any Israeli school, there's a gate that goes all around it, a metal gate, and then a little booth at the front with a security guard, and he checks everybody who comes in, and they have a firearm. But you know, if that's what you're going to take away from Israel's gun culture and ignore the very strict gun control that you have, then you're not really presenting the full picture at all. I mean, he can have the security guards at the door, but what about the strict gun control? And I don't think he's going to be so hot on that.
Does Mike Huckabee have a point, though, when it comes to how Israelis deal with security, like focusing not necessarily on the weapon, but on a person with intent?
I mean, there's all different types of ways that Israeli security officials focus on, you know, handle security. And they have a whole, you know, very extensive toolkit. And a lot of it, yes, it's true, does deal with getting to the person before, forming a profile on what the person would be. But it's not all or nothing. It's not all one or the other. That they do have all of that intel, but they also realize that it's also very, very important that you control firearms and keep them out of the hands of these people. Because, you know, the two go hand in hand. You can have all types of great intel to try to get to these people, but if they still have very easy access to firearms, you're not really completing the whole picture. And the two go hand in hand, and the two are essential, both of them.
So what do you think the U.S. could learn from Israel in this area?
Wow, that's a good one. I've often gone back and forth on this and try to figure out, you know, because there are guns in Israel. There's a lot of soldiers and security personnel, so you see guns, but you don't have these things happen. And so there could be, you know, societal issues in terms of, you know, closer family ties here. It's a smaller country. There's all types of cultural or societal reasons you could think of. For one thing, you know, it's not just the gun control. You also don't have the gun fetish here or the gun obsession here. So it's not just controlling the guns. It's also how people relate to guns. And they don't have the same cultural relation to firearms here that they do in America. I mean, obviously, you know, people here love action movies also, and they love cop shows, and kids play with toy guns and G.I. Joes when they're kids here as well. But you don't have that same relationship with guns here. Everyone or the vast majority of people are enlisted in the compulsory draft when they're 18. And the first time they encounter a gun is in the military. So they associate it with a military necessity, not a hobby, not a thing, you know, for fun or a cool accessory. So there's a different connotation with guns. There's a different relationship with guns. And I think all of that plays a part. But in terms of all of those kind of social issues, you know, those are the types of things that are rather subjective and could, you know, be the subject of a very long dissertation or two. Mm-hmm. I think when it comes down to it, if you look at what's very concrete on the ground, is the gun control. The point is, I think that Huckabee was trying to talk about one aspect of the reality here, which is the security guards at schools. And I think you can make a good case that public institutions in America, they have more security. And I think you can definitely make a good case about that. But Israel has also made the statement that you can't just have that. You need to have strict gun control, and you need to have a better relationship with firearms and to see them for what they are, which is killing machines and not a toy.
Writer Ben Hartman speaking with us from Tel Aviv. Thanks so much for your time, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
We also wanted to see how this grimly American phenomenon is reported abroad. China provides an interesting example. Journalist Isaac Stonefish reported from Beijing for years and still follows affairs there closely. Very happy to have you in the studio with us finally, Isaac. So what kind of headlines have you been seeing from China on this shooting in Parkland, Florida?
So it's so surprising because normally you read Chinese state media headlines about American crimes and misdemeanors and foibles, and they're so exaggerated or they feel out of place or they feel extreme. But this is such a clear tragedy and such a clear problem that America faces that Chinese state media doesn't need to hype it in any way. I think they have that hectoring tone with other things, but I think quite smartly from a propaganda perspective, they're just letting the horrific facts speak for themselves.
What other things would they have that hectoring tone about?
I think in terms of racial issues, they like to pretend that China is a racial paradise. A very crude approximation of what actually happens in China, but that's how state media often likes to portray it. Whereas for gun violence, it's not at all a problem in China. China is exceptionally safe when it comes to things like that. I think the idea is that when China calls out America for its racial problems, for people who know, it shines light on China's racial problems, and it's embarrassing and it's hypocritical, and it smacks of this kind of falseness, this tawdriness. Whereas for gun violence, they've decided to report it more as, hey, this is happening, this is a big problem. And because China doesn't have a gun violence problem, it rings true.
So not a big gun violence problem in China, but what about attacks in schools? I feel like I've seen that before in China. Does that happen?
It happens very frequently, but that's the very basic arithmetic about not being able to buy guns. China has a huge problem with school attacks, but if you have a knife, you're wounding a dozen people. You're not killing a dozen people. So a Wall Street Journal reporter, Josh Chin, recently tweeted that the weekend before this attack, there was an incident. This was at a school. It was at a mall. But a disturbed man stabbed 14 people. One of them died. If he had a gun, dozens of people might have died. But not having access to guns means that you can do so much less damage.
I noticed you said this is a disturbed man. Did the Chinese media report kind of the mental health side of that story?
They did. And it's also it's unfair for me to say he could have been perfectly coherent and not disturbed at all. That's the way that Chinese media reported it. And it's similar. I think it's a good point that you brought up because it's similar to what Trump says. He's deranged. It's not the problem with the system. It's a problem with the man. And I think Beijing is also trying to say, hey, it's not that we have these big societal problems. It's that this guy's a little crazy.
When you were living in China, Isaac, and something terrible happened here, for example, Sandy Hook a few years ago, what kind of questions did you get from Chinese about that?
I think there wasn't that much attention paid to these specific incidents. And I think when Chinese people were asking about violence in America, it was much more what they had seen on television or watched in movies. It didn't have a relation to a specific horrific incident. So there's a lot of questions about, hey, so in America, does everyone have guns? Can you really easily buy a gun?
And generally, China sees the United States as a violent place?
It does.
International Affairs Analyst Isaac Stonefish, thanks. Really good to see you.
Great to see you. Thanks.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a peaceful weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.